17. Seems like the town is full of machines, said Douglas, running. Mr. Offman and his happiness machine, Miss Fern and Miss Roberta and their green machine. Now, Charlie, what are you handing me?
A time machine, panted Charlie Woodman, pacing him. Mothers, scouts, engines, honor.
Travels in the past and future? John Huff asked, easily circling them.
Only in the past, but you can't have everything.
Here we are. Charlie Woodman pulled up at a hedge. Douglas peered in at the old house.
Heck, that's Colonel Freely's place.
Can't be no time machine in there. He's no inventor. And if he was, we'd have known about an important thing like a time machine years ago.
Charlie and John tiptoed up the front porch steps.
Douglas snorted and shook his head, staying at the bottom of the steps.
Okay, Douglas, said Charlie. Be a knucklehead. Sure, Colonel Freely didn't invent this time machine, but he's got a proprietary interest in it, and it's been here all the time. We were too darn dumb to notice. So long, Douglas Spaulding, to you.
Charlie took John's elbow as though he was escorting a lady, opened the front porch screen, and went in. The screen door did not slam. Douglas had caught the screen and was following, silently. Charlie walked across the enclosed porch, knocked, and opened the inside door. They all peered down a long, dark hall toward a room that was lit like an undersea grotto, soft green, dim, and watery.
Colonel Freely?
Silence.
He don't hear so good, whispered Charlie, but he told me to just come on in and yell. Colonel?
The only answer was the dust sifting down and around the spiral stairwell from above. Then there was a faint stir in that undersea chamber at the far end of the hall. They moved carefully along and peered into a room which contained but two pieces of furniture, an old man and a chair. They resembled each other, both so thin you could see just how they had been put together, ball and socket, sinew and joint. The rest of the room was raw floorboards, naked walls and ceiling, and vast quantities of silent air.
He looks dead, whispered Douglas. No, he's just thinking up new places to travel to, said Charlie, very proud and quiet. Colonel?
One of the pieces of brown furniture moved, and it was the Colonel, blinking around, focusing, and smiling a wild and toothless smile.
Charlie! Colonel, Doug and John here came to...
Welcome, boys. Sit down. Sit down.
The boys sat uneasily on the floor. But where's the... said Douglas. Charlie jabbed his ribs quickly.
Where's a what? Asked Colonel Freely.
Where's the point in us talking, he means?
Charlie grimaced at Douglas, then smiled at the old man. We got nothing to say, Colonel.
You say something.
Beware, Charlie. Old men only lie in wait for people to ask them to talk. Then they rattle on like a rusty elevator wheezing up a shaft.
Ching Ling Su, suggested Charlie, casually.
Hey,
said the Colonel.
Boston, Charlie prompted. 1910.
Boston, 1910, the Colonel frowned. Why, Ching Ling Su, of course.
Yes, sir, Colonel.
Let me see now,
the Colonel's voice murmured. It drifted away on serene lake waters.
Let me see.
The boys waited. Colonel Freely closed his eyes.
October 1st, 1910. A calm, cool, fine autumn night. The Boston Variety Theater. Yes, there it is. Full house. All waitin'. Orchestra, fanfare, curtain. Ching Ling Su, the great Oriental magician. There he is on stage. And there I am, front row center. The bullet trick, he cries. Volunteers! The man next to me goes up. "Examine the rifle," says Ching. "Mark the bullet," says he. "Now fire this marked bullet from this rifle, using my face for a target." And, says Ching, "at the far end of the stage, I will catch the bullet in my teeth."
Colonel Freely took a deep breath and paused. Douglas was staring at him, half puzzled, half in awe. John Huff and Charlie were completely lost. Now the old man went on, his head and body frozen, only his lips moving.
"Ready, aim, fire!" cries Ching Ling Su. Bang! The rifle cracks. Bang! Ching Ling Su shrieks. He staggers. He falls. His face all red. Pandemonium! Audience on its feet. Something wrong with the rifle. Dead, someone says. And they're right. Dead. Horrible. Horrible. I'll always remember. His face a mask of red. The curtain coming down fast and the women weeping. 1910. Boston. Variety Theater. Poor man.
Colonel Freely slowly opened his eyes.
"Boy, Colonel," said Charlie, "that was fine. Now how about Pawnee Bill?"
"Pawnee Bill?"
"And the time you was on the prairie way back in 75.
"Pawnee Bill." The colonel moved into darkness. 1875, yes. Me and Pawnee Bill on a little rise in the middle of the prairie, waiting. "Shh," says Pawnee Bill. "Listen." The prairie, like a big stage, all set for the storm to come. Thunder, soft. Thunder again, not so soft. And across that prairie, as far as the eye could see, this big, ominous, yellow-dark cloud full of black lightning somehow sunk to earth, 50 miles wide, 50 miles long, a mile high, and no more than an inch off the ground. "Lord," I cried, "Lord," from up on my hill, "Lord!" The earth pounded like a mad heart, boys, a heart gone to panic. My bones shook fit to break. The earth shook. Rat-a-tat, rat-a-tat, boom! Rumble. That's a rare word, rumble. Oh, how that mighty storm rumbled along, down, up, and over the risers, and all you could see was the cloud and nothing inside. "That's them," cried Pawnee Bill. And the cloud was dust. Not vapors or rain, no, but prairie dust flung up from the tinder-dry grass like fine cornmeal, like pollen all blazed with sunlight now, for the sun had come out. I shouted again. Why? Because in all that hellfire, filtering dust, now a veil moved aside, and I saw them, I swear it. The grand army of the ancient prairie. The bison. The buffalo.
The colonel let the silence build, then broke it again.
Heads like giant negroes' fists, bodies like locomotives. 20, 50, 200,000 iron missiles shot out of the west, gone off the track, and flailing cinders, their eyes like blazing coals, rumbling toward oblivion. I saw that the dust rose up, and for a little while showed me that sea of humps, of dolloping manes, black, shaggy waves rising, falling. "Shoot," says Pawnee Bill, "shoot!" And I cock and aim. "Shoot," he says. And I stand there feeling like God's right hand, looking at the great vision of strength and violence going by, midnight at noon, like a glinty funeral train all black and long and sad and forever. And you don't fire at a funeral train now, do you, boys? Do you? All I wanted then was for the dust to sink again and cover the black shapes of doom which pummeled and jostled on in great, burdensome commotions. And, boys, the dust came down. The cloud hid the million feet that were drumming up the thunder and dusting out the storm. I heard Pawnee Bill curse and hit my arm. but I was glad I hadn't touched that cloud or the power within that cloud with so much as a pellet of lead. I just wanted to stand watching time bundle by in great trundlings, all hid by the storm the bison made and carried with them toward eternity. An hour, 3 hours, 6 it took for the storm to pass on away over the horizon toward less kind men than me. Pawnee Bill was gone. I stood alone, stone deaf. I walked all numb through a town 100 miles south and heard not the voices of men and was satisfied not to hear. For a little while I wanted to remember the thunder. I hear it still on summer afternoons like this, when the rain shapes over the lake, a fearsome, wondrous sound, one I wish you might have heard. The dim light filtered through Colonel Freely's nose, which was large and like white porcelain, which cupped a very thin and tepid orange tea indeed.
"Is he asleep?" asked Douglas at last.
"No," said Charlie, "just recharging his batteries."
Colonel Freely breathed swiftly, softly, as if he'd run a long way. At last he opened his eyes.
"Yes, sir,"
said Charlie in admiration. "Hello, Charlie." The colonel smiled at the boys puzzledly.
"That's Doug and that's John," said Charlie.
"Howdy do, boys."
The boys said hello.
"But," said Douglas, "where is the—" "My gosh, you're dumb," Charlie jabbed Douglas in the arm. He turned to the colonel. "You were saying, sir?"
"Was I?"
murmured the old man.
"The Civil War," suggested John Huff quietly. "Does he remember that?"
"Do I remember?" said the colonel. "Oh, I do, I do."
His voice trembled as he shut up his eyes again.
"Everything. Except which side I fought on."
"The color of your uniform," Charlie began.
"Colors begin to run on you," whispered the colonel. "It's gotten hazy. I see soldiers with me, but a long time ago I stopped seeing color in their coats or caps. I was born in Illinois, raised in Virginia, married in New York, built a house in Tennessee, and now, very late, here I am, good Lord, back in Greentown. So you see why the colors run and blend."
"But you remember which side of hills you fought on?"
Charlie did not raise his voice. "Did the sun rise on your left or right? Did you march toward Canada or Mexico?"
"Seems some mornings the sun rose on my good right hand, some mornings over my left shoulder. We marched all directions. It's most 70 years since. You forget suns and mornings that long past."
"You remember winning, don't you? A battle won, somewhere."
"No," said the old man, deep under. "I don't remember anyone winning, anywhere, any time. War's never a winning thing, Charlie. You just lose all the time, and the one who loses last asks for terms. All I remember is a lot of losing and sadness and nothing good but the end of it. The end of it, Charles. That was a winning all to itself, having nothing to do with guns. But I don't suppose that's the kind of victory you boys mean for me to talk on."
"Antietam," said John Huff. "Ask about Antietam."
"I was there."
The boy's eyes grew bright.
"Bull Run. Ask him Bull Run."
"I was there,"
softly.
"What about Shiloh?"
"There's never been a year in my life I haven't thought, what a lovely name, and what a shame to see it only on battle records."
"Shiloh, then. Fort Sumter?"
"I saw the first puffs of powder smoke. A dreaming voice. So many things come back. Oh, so many things. I remember songs. All's quiet along the Potomac tonight, where the soldiers lie peacefully dreaming. Their tents in the rays of the clear autumn moon, or the light of the watchfire, are gleaming. Remember, remember, all quiet along the Potomac tonight. No sound save the rush of the river. While soft falls the dew on the face of the dead, the pickets off duty forever. After the surrender, Mr. Lincoln, on the White House balcony, asked the band to play "Look Away, Look Away, Look Away, Dixieland." And then there was the Boston lady who one night wrote a song will last 1,000 years. Mine eyes have seen the glory of the coming of the Lord. He is trampling out the vintage where the grapes of wrath are stored. Late nights I feel my mouth move singing back in another time. Ye cavaliers of Dixie, who guard the southern shores, when the boys come home in triumph, brother, with the laurels they shall gain. So many songs, sung on both sides, blowing north, blowing south on the night winds. We are coming, Father Abraham, 300,000 more, tenting tonight, tenting tonight, tenting on the old campground. Hurrah, hurrah, we bring the jubilee. Hurrah, hurrah, the flag that makes us free. The old man's voice faded. The boys sat for a long while without moving. Then Charlie turned and looked at Douglas and said,
"Well, is he or isn't he?"
Douglas breathed twice and said,
"He sure is."
The colonel opened his eyes.
"I sure am what?" he asked.
"A time machine," murmured Douglas. "A time machine."
The colonel looked at the boys for a full 5 seconds. Now it was his voice that was full of awe.
"Is that what you boys call me?"
"Yes, sir, colonel. Yes, sir."
The colonel sat slowly back in his chair and looked at the boys and looked at his hands and then looked at the blank wall beyond them steadily. Charlie arose.
"Well, I guess we better go. So long, and thanks, Colonel."
"What? Oh, so long, boys."
Douglas and John and Charlie went on tiptoe out the door. Colonel Freely, though they crossed his line of vision, did not see them go. In the street, the boys were startled when someone shouted from a first-floor window above,
"Hey!"
They looked up.
"Yes, sir, Colonel."
The colonel leaned out, waving one arm.
"I thought about what you said, boys."
"Yes, sir."
"And you're right. Why didn't I think of it before? A time machine, by God, a time machine."
"Yes, sir."
"So long, boys. Come aboard any time."
At the end of the street, they turned again, and the colonel was still waving. They waved back, feeling warm and good, then went on.
"Chug-a-chug," said John. "I can travel 12 years into the past. Wham-chug-ding."
"Yeah,"
said Charlie, looking back at that quiet house. "But you can't go 100 years."
"No," mused John. "I can't go 100 years. That's really traveling. That's really some machine."
They walked for a full minute in silence, looking at their feet. They came to a fence.
"Last one over this fence," said Douglas, "is a girl."
All the way home, they called Douglas Dora.